Good evening. I'm Fiona Branton, president of the Harvard Law School Forum, and I'd like to welcome you all here tonight. Tonight, we're pleased to have with us Mr. Arturo Cruz. Tonight, introducing Mr. Cruz, we have Professor Detlef Bott. He's currently in his 28th year of teaching here at the law school, specializing in corporations and international law. I'm pleased to present Professor Bott.
Thank you.
Good evening. Over the many years that I've been here, I have seen a distinguished parade of visitors here at the forum, and I'm glad to add to that list tonight Senor Arturo Cruz of Nicaragua. You have the basics of his biography in the leaflet that is handed out. Let me just say that this is an interesting time in Nicaragua. There is, of course, that old Chinese saying that it's a curse to say, may you live in interesting times. But this is a time that is both interesting and hopeful, hopeful and delicate in the sense that things could still go very wrong. You see unusual combinations of people in photographs, the Cardinal, Senor Ortega, and so forth together. What we hope to get, I think, tonight is a closer, more sensitive, more informed sense of what is happening there, what the prospects are, and what the remaining obstacles are. You will note from his biography that while Mr. Cruz has done a variety of things, including being a banker, thus being close to my field of corporation law, he spent a great deal of time in being in opposition to the government, which in many places is a full-time, honorable, and necessary career. But I'm sure that he hopes that he too will come to a world in Nicaragua which is a world of peace. And let me finally say that I hope that peace will also prevail here and that we will have an interesting, pointed, at times vigorous perhaps, dialogue, but within the bounds of the rules of civilized discourse. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Good.
Thank you, Professor. Thank you very much. This morning, when I got up, I said to myself, what in heavens am I going to go to do to Harvard? The reason I asked myself that was, first of all, I more than once have played the role of the slave in the Roman circus. But I did have, in the first place, a commitment to honor. I accepted to come here on April 12th. And in addition, I felt also that I had to come, because although I am not an actor in the drama of my country, I follow it rather closely. And I was asked to expand on two subjects. One of them, Professor, is that I was told by the organizers of this meeting that some students are interested in knowing the reasons why I quit the directorate of the Unified Nicaraguan Opposition early this year. And although that's somewhat trivial, I will deal with it for some moments, and then I would like to enter into the subject that I think it's more worthy of this forum, and which is what prospects for peace are in my country now, and in Central America in general. With all due respect to the forum, I would like to make just a comment, and it's just a comment. On the airplane, I look at the brochure you have, and I couldn't help reading a paragraph that says, in 1984, Nicaraguan leader Daniel Ortega defended the Sandinista revolution. 6 months later, Contra Arturo Cruz voiced his opposition to it. I'd like to say that we, the Nicaraguan dissidents, when I say dissidents, I am referring to those of us who believed in the revolution but who dissent strongly with the orientation given to it, that we have certainly failed in conveying something which is not seen by the world, that in our country and in the rest of Central America, there is not struggle between two poles, the extreme left and the extreme right, but that the real struggle is between both poles against the center, that there is a democratic center. Fortunately, for the future of Central America, Daniel Ortega, who is a revolutionary leader, and who is a pragmatist among the 9 members of the National Directorate, without any question, I would say fortunately for him, also, instead of the Sandinistas having in Central America as heads of state in the other countries what the radicals in the National Directorate would like to have, which would be somebody like Martinez in El Salvador, they have Duarte. Somebody like Cuico in Guatemala, they have Cerezo. And somebody like Carillas in Honduras, they have Ascona. And more important of all, there is a man of vision in San Jose de Costa Rica, President Oscar Arias. Let me tell you that if I told all the reasons why I left the Nicaraguan opposition directorate, it would take too long a time. So I'll try to make a synthesis and give you some specifics. If I have to be candid with you, I have to admit that at the end of 1986, the Iran-Contra scandal obviously influenced my decision to leave. But it was, I want to tell you, at most a triggering cause. There were several other reasons that weighed heavily in that decision and that I was harboring for a long time. I also took into consideration at that moment what I deemed was a duty as a Nicaraguan, and also that I had some loyalty to my family. Again, if I have to be honest with you, I had a feeling of self-guilty. I was embarrassed. I was angry with myself. I was fed up. But I would also be a liar if I told you that what I did it purely for emotions. There was some rationality in it. One of the reasons that were leading me to take the decision that I did was what I perceived to be the futility of the war. I made the mistake, I admit. I have made many mistakes. But there is one single mistake, I mean, that it's the mother of them all, and that was to have joined in June of 1985, the Nicaraguan resistance waging war. It was an error because it didn't behoove me to do it. Yesterday I was talking to a very, very intelligent lady pundit of your press, and who reminded me about a good book by Miss Barbara Tuchman, which tells you about errors that are made. And she said that Tuchman, in the book, I don't recall that, but she said, Tuchman said, that usually when you make errors, for some time you're not aware of them. And that when you find out that you have made the errors, you refuse to accept those errors. So I was facing that. And I decided that I had to accept my errors. So let me go then to the reasons briefly. Some of them. One of them was what I perceived. I said the futility of the war. U.S. policy had been floundering. It had not been able to develop a consensus of domestic support in this country for its policy of backing the anti-Sandinista rebels. But to a large extent, of course, we, the Nicaraguan anti-Sandinista political leadership, were responsible for this situation. We had failed to give the movement a credible political dimension. As a result of that failure, the campesinos who were struggling in the mountains and jungles of Nicaragua were accepted as freedom fighters neither by most Americans nor by most Europeans, even worse, by most Latin Americans, and worst of all, by many Nicaraguans. We were failing. We were still the Contras. Moreover, I didn't see at the time any light at the end of the tunnel. At the time I made public my decision to leave, in a note that I gave to La Nación in San Jose, Costa Rica, and to the Miami Herald in Miami, I stated that I was concerned over the fact, as a Nicaraguan, that all I could see in the U.S. strategy, in its policy, was a policy of containment. That is to say, to contain the Sandinistas within the borders. It was obvious. Ever since 1981, when I came as ambassador to Washington, I observed that there was already a consensus existing between the White House and Capitol Hill that the FMLN was to be denied a victory in El Salvador. And that remains to be so. As a matter of fact, in a conversation that I had with the president of that country, we talked about the situation. Shortly before I decided to leave, we talked with candor, I mean, how both of us saw things. And I could see how difficult his role was because there were several agendas, the agendas of the left, the agendas of the right, the agendas of the of the guerrillas, his own agenda, the agenda of the United States. And he said, I have to keep on watching all of them in order to be able to do something myself. And so also through the conversation, it became clear to me that the Nicaraguan guerrillas that were bleeding my country were part of a wall of contention and also of a wall of protection of the rest of Central America, but at the expense of Nicaraguan blood. That U.S. strategy, the way I perceive it, I might be wrong, but that's the way I saw it. I could see that it also was predicated in preserving the status quo in Costa Rica, in Guatemala, as well, and in Honduras. That also part of that policy was converting Honduras into a military bulwark. And at the same time, there was a commitment of the United States that was announced to defend Honduras in case of a Sandinista aggression. In Costa Rica, of course, the status quo is preserved by two obvious facts. One of them is the moral authority of the democracy of Costa Rica, and the other is the status of Costa Rica as a member of the Rio Treaty of Mutual Security. So, Nicaraguan guerrillas were a symmetry that was being established with the Salvadoran guerrillas, and there was no hope whatsoever, in my judgment. In the meantime, young Nicaraguan soldiers on both sides and civilians were dying. But all of my four sons were safe here. And so were my fellow Nicaraguans who called for war from a podium at a hotel lounge in Miami. None of us was at the war front. Nor it was the children of campesinos and their mothers and fathers and brothers and sisters, as well as babies and old people, who were being killed or maimed in northern Nicaragua. So we have a moral question. It was a fact that the Sandinistas, in my judgment, were guilty of injustice, and theirs was a regime of force. It could be said that rebellion was justified. However, after several years of bloodshed, the Sandinistas didn't give any signs of being willing to negotiate. That meant that our two-track approach was not functioning. The Sandinistas had spurned all the peace overtures we had made to them. In such a no-win situation, one wondered whether it was morally right to continue assuming the responsibility involved as a member of the UNO Directorate. Another reason was, let us be very honest, ideological differences within the coalition. It was difficult to hide the antagonism existing between the FDN in the north and the Southern Front. In the north, the prevailing elements at high level were former diehard guardias and somocistas, not so the soldiers, who are mostly campesinos. In the south, the leadership and the file and rank were largely made of Sandinista dissidents or guardias who had rebelled at some time against Somoza. As one of the three directors, I tried to preserve a balance, notwithstanding the fact that I leaned to the south. However, the Somocista clique that controls the FDN would not resist expressing their hatred toward those who believed in the revolution but dissented from the Sandinistas' totalitarian traits. In their views, that was not enough. Once you had served the revolution, you were always considered by them a piricuaco, a wandering dog, a Sandinista. Therefore, you were the guardia's enemy forever. Ecumenism for them had no meaning. They wanted the acceptance of the other forces of their hegemonical role. Another reason was unwillingness of the FDN clique to accept reforms. When we formed the Unified Nicaraguan Opposition, it was agreed that the three-man directorate would assume all functions, military, political, and diplomatic. Far from it, the FDN rejected unity and insisted in that hegemonical role. I saw that there was no reason for me to stay in an alliance with those who were not my friends. We were being undermined day in and day out. We signed an agreement, I recall, in 1985, before we created the umbrella that was announced in San Salvador in June of that year. But the truth is that that clique treated that commitment with the same contempt that the Sandinistas had earlier reneged the 1979 commitments before the Organization of American States to establish pluralism and democracy in Nicaragua. I felt like leaving, of course, but I was persuaded to stay for the cause. So we came to May of 1986, convinced that it was impossible to settle our differences, and that it was impossible to prevail upon the clique to improve our contrafaces in matters of human rights, clear commitment to democratic principles, pluralism. I felt I had to go. It was then when I practically stepped out. We held a meeting in Miami and signed a proposal of reforms. But I knew that as soon as the dust settled, the reforms would be derailed and I would be eased out. I just stayed that half year with one foot on the door, trying to avoid publicity, but this time not for the sake of causes, because our causes were different, but for the sake of formality. At the beginning of March, my wife and I decided not to tell anybody, and we just left. I just left. In those days, a friend of mine was quoted by the Washington Post. He said that I had bent backwards so many times that I was finished. He was right. As a politician, I am finished. But I have also learned something very useful as a man, even at my age. And it is how healthy it is to stay away from alliances with those who are not your friends, and from the U.S. embrace. And this last year has been one of the happiest in my life. I am sorry that I dedicated this time to something so trivial. I did it because, as I indicated, I was requested to it. Anyway, the reform of the contras has become irrelevant because the contras could become outmoded any moment. There is a new reality, the Arias Plan. In February of this year, Alfonso Robelo and I met with Costa Rican President Oscar Arias at his home in San Jose de Costa Rica. He had a yellow pad and a pencil. That's all he had. And he began to jot down some of ideas relating to his peace initiative. It was a proposal that had many features in common with previous peace plans: ceasefire, amnesty, restitution of freedoms and civic rights, dialogue for the establishment of democracy, and finally elections. However, this one was not going to be another platitude because it had two differences with the others. First, it removed all the pretext for the Sandinistas not to accept it. And second, because its moral, its author's moral authority forced all the other actors to accept it. Nobody could afford to ignore it. Neither the United States, nor the Sandinistas, nor the other Central Americans, nor the Contras. Nobody could ignore that proposal. It is so effective, as we all have seen, that in August, it was signed in Guatemala as Esquipulas II by the five Central American presidents. Contadora has been dragging its feet since January of 1983. And shortly after, it won the Nobel Peace Prize. In Nicaragua, the Arias Plan has a powerful ally, the Church. The most significant achievement thus far, in my opinion, are the chairmanship of Miguel Cardinal Obando y Bravo of the National Commission of Reconciliation and his role as mediator for the ceasefire. The first deadline for compliance on November 5th was met, not with perfection, but some breakthroughs have been made. The opposition must be flexible and avoid claiming non-compliance prematurely, or worse, without foundation. It would be a disregard for peace to try to pin down strict compliance on December 5, when the Monitoring International Commission also gives its verdict. I sincerely hope, and I am sure it will be so, that on January 5th, when the five Central American presidents meet, they will not consider that date the end of this exercise. It has to go beyond that date, and it must be continued. And in the case of Nicaragua, I for one believe in what a friend of mine, Emilio Alvarez Montalban, says, that the Arias proposal is not a trap for anybody but an opportunity. I believe that this time the opposition must not make the mistake that we made in 1984. In 1984, we made a terrible mistake with the pace of the elections. Freedom House has offered me to publish my version of that experience before the end of this year. I don't know whether we'll do it. I hope they do, but it's already printed. And let me tell you, quite frankly, that the Sandinistas did commit fraud, but not only could not prove it, but what's worse, we were perceived by international opinion as we were sabotaging the electoral process. We should have gone to the elections. We should have registered the candidacies. And we should have faced whatever difficulties there were, but we didn't. So now, if the opposition is not careful in not giving the impression to international opinion that they are being inflexible, the Sandinistas may get away once more with what they want. They will come out with a cosmetic arrangement with impunity. The struggle in Nicaragua is more than against the Sandinistas. It should be for democracy. It must be waged entirely inside Nicaragua and exclusively in the political arena. The external opposition has no other role to play, in my opinion, now than to support the internal opposition. The Arias Plan is, by all accounts, the most effective mechanism for obtaining peace in Central America, in Nicaragua in particular, which is the one that I am so concerned about as a Nicaraguan. Those who have heard the plan, of course, say that the president of Costa Rica is being naive. that the communist Sandinistas will not comply with anything, and that they will only gain time for their consolidation. Those who say that ignore two facts. One, that we are dealing with a sophisticated statesman in Oscar Arias. And second, that he has a stick behind his back. And that is the moral authority that Costa Rica and the rest of Central America would have this time to denounce any action of the Sandinistas reneging of the commitment that they made in Guatemala. Therefore, those who sincerely want peace, not just the conquest of power or the preservation of power, must abide by the Arias plan. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Senor Cruz, for that most clear and most enlightening presentation. And we're now at the point for questions. I will recognize questions first from this side. Please be concise.
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, Mr. Cruz. I'd just like to know, what do you think should be American policy towards Nicaragua right now?
Simply to comply with the Arias plan. If the Arias plan calls for a ceasefire between the rebels and the Sandinistas, if the Arias plan calls for the reestablishment in Nicaragua of freedoms, freedom of the press, freedom, all the other freedoms, if Nicaragua complies, the other parties must comply. Of course, the United States is not a signatory to the Arias plan. It is not. But Honduras, in my opinion, should also comply by not providing its territory to anything that could be, the Sandinistas could claim is an aggression against them, and so forth. But although the United States is not a party to the agreement, and I believe, by the way, that the United States, as a free nation, as a sovereign nation, has the right to have its own policy towards the plan, and in the way which was announced by Habib, by Ambassador Habib, made sense. For the United States, he used to say, anything of an agreement would be acceptable to us if it meets three requirements. One, that it is comprehensive. That is to say that it deals with the political, with the military, with the social, and so forth. The Arias plan does. Second, that it is simultaneous, that is to say that you deal with the solution at the same time of all the problems. It is being done so. And finally, that it is verifiable. I mean, you have all the mechanism in the Arias plan for verification. What should the United States policy should be to support the Arias plan? If approving aid of a military nature to the rebels at this time would put in jeopardy the implementation of the Arias plan, in my opinion, it should not be done. But at the same time, the United States has to safeguard its own interests. In that regard, I don't think anybody can complain if the U.S. government continues to provide non-lethal aid to the rebels and watch how the process goes. And whenever the moment, we reach a moment when it is clear that the process has succeeded, it should withdraw all support.
This lady here.
Lots of media attention on the Arias plan lately has been on a ceasefire and negotiations between the Contras and the Sandinistas. But as you know, the Arias plan also requires democratization and respect for human rights. I'd like to know what you think are the biggest human rights problems in Nicaragua right now, and what specific steps the Sandinista government should take in order to comply with the human rights provisions of the Arias plan.
I'll tell you three violations of human rights in Nicaragua. One of them is that, as, and let me start with something that might not, that make me sound perhaps harsh, if you wish, but I'll tell you. In 1985, or rather 1984, to correct myself, the Human Rights Commission of the Organization of American States, in its report, made a warning a priori, which was ignored by international observers, by the media, by everybody. And the warning was that one of the basic human rights of an individual was the right to elect and to be elected. And that the Sandinistas were violating that right because through the control of the organs of the states, the Sandinistas were placing themselves in a position of advantage against other contenders. So that's one human right violation that has to be corrected. And in order to correct that human right violation, the Sandinistas have to agree that they have to allow for freedom of political organization, freedom of expression, and they, more important than anything else, they have to ask their turbas to stay home. Because it is not true that the turbas are spontaneous expressions of the people, of solidarity with the revolution, and of expressions of disapproval of whoever is the victim of the turban. We have to do that, okay? That's one. Another violation of human rights that I believe that has taken place in Nicaragua is injustice. The number of prisoners, of former members of the National Guard, and believe me, they are not saints of my devotion, but the truth is that in Nicaragua today you have 4,000, 5,000, I don't know how many thousand former members of the National Guard who are prisoners. The Sandinistas claim that they are, should not be freed because they are murderers and torturers and repressors. There may be 100 of them who are that. But the rest of them are the orderlies of the generals, and the privates. They are the likes of the chauffeur, the driver of an army chaplain, who because of doing that was condemned to 30 years in prison. It is ironic to see that you can see in Managua, not only in Miami, but in Managua, you can see here and there a former general of the Guardia Nacional walking by the streets. I'm glad they're doing it. I'm not suggesting that they should be put in prison. But except for a few colonels and a few majors and a few captains, most of those former guardias who are prisoners there are the privates, and I repeat, the orderlies of the generals. Of course, the Sandinistas argue that if they free them, then they will go to join the Contras. But the Sandinistas have to understand that the shield of protection of the revolution is not war. The shield of protection of the revolution is justice. And if they comply with the Arias plan, and if they give freedoms, and if they restitute justice in Nicaragua, there will be no more Contras. And they don't have to worry about them. And besides that, it's a risk they have to take. That's a terrible human right violation. And the other human right violation might sound to you perhaps far-fetched, but I want to tell it to you the way I look at it. As Pablo Antonio Cuadra said, that the first duty of a statesman is to protect his people. And that calls for prudence, so forth. But I believe that the Sandinistas have acted in such a reckless way that you have today a terrible situation in the national economy. Of course, part of the economic disaster is due to the war, absolutely. Part is also due to the fact that there is a disarray in the whole region, because if we have to be honest, we must admit that if the Nicaraguan Cordoba has gone from 10 Cordobas per dollar 10 years ago, roughly, to 20,000 Cordobas, also the Mexican peso has gone from a similar level to 2,300 pesos after the devaluation of yesterday. So there are also economic reasons. You have to be fair about this thing. But the main reason why Nicaragua is suffering shortages, a country that was a producer of surplus of food and so forth, is the ideological inflexibility of the Sandinista Front. And as long as they continue to believe that their party is our people, then we will be in trouble. I mean, in my opinion, that's a serious violation of human rights from which all others are derived. But we have Madame to believe in what the church leadership says. That's another thing that very few people pay any attention. I have not seen in the articles written by my fellow compatriots in Miami, whom I say, it's wonderful, it's admirable to see them from a podium in the comfort of a hotel calling for war and so forth. I have not seen them mention, one of them mention one word of what the bishop said last September. You know what the bishop said? The bishop said in their pastoral of September that we have a duty to work for peace, and that it would be wrong because of previous disappointments to adopt an attitude of distrust. We have to make an effort to meet all of us halfway. And the bishop said that if that's the attitude, we all will be responsible for the terrible sufferings the Nicaraguan people are submitted today. Well, at the same time, of course, said that loving peace does not mean that you will accept the peace of force, but the peace of truth and the peace of right.
Question, next question from the West Side.
Yes, sir.
Military problem. Obviously, the Nicaraguan resistance fighters, the Contras, have some kind of area that they've taken over, or they have some kind of battle line. And I've heard conflicting reports. Some people say that they're just hiding out in the jungle. Some people say that they've actually taken over areas of Nicaraguan countryside. Just where is the army, and where are they going to put the army when the peace happens? Are they just going to divide it up the middle? Or are they going to say, you go and camp in that field over there? Or, what are they going to do with the soldiers and the military apparatus in order to have the peace come about?
Well, that is a question that I think you should address to Adolfo Calero or one of the leaders of the Contra leadership. I've been away 1 year already, a fact that very people seem to be aware of. But as a citizen, as an observer, I can tell you, yes, there has been a very noticeable improvement in the fighting capacity of the Contra forces, of the rebel forces, for the simple reason that, as we were talking at dinner, a few of us a moment ago, is the red eye. Because it was always very strange that while the Soviets provided the Sandinistas with such an awesome weapon like the Heim 24, the rebels had to go into the black market and buy Soviet-made SAM-7s. The logical thing for the United States should have been to provide the rebels with a Stinger. They didn't, but at least they gave them the red eye, and that's why you see that every other day you read a report that Sandinista helicopters and Sandinista airplanes are being dropped. I only have one point of view with respect to what you say, and it is that a ceasefire has to be negotiated. They are going to negotiate it. That it should not mean surrender of any side. A ceasefire simply means you and I put our guns aside while we discuss peace. And that, I don't know whether the three havens that the Sandinistas offer are enough. I imagine that the experts will look into it. It may be necessary to have 10 or 15, some in the north, some in the south, some in the east. Something of that has to be done. But I have also the belief that while the rebel forces should be represented somehow by the internal opposition, I think that there is a distinction between discussing a ceasefire and negotiating peace. It's logical that the ceasefire be negotiated between those who are in arms. But peace, perhaps, which is based on democracy, should be negotiated by the forces inside Nicaragua. Or what provisions will be taken to safeguard the security of the troops and so forth? Only the leaders could answer that to you.
The east side this time.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I really appreciate the frankness that you've showed us in your comments tonight and the humility you've shown admitting mistakes that you've made in the past. I think it's a very honorable trait. And one thing I'm curious about is that you've dealt extensively with the CIA in the past. You've accepted money from them and you've seen how they operate in carrying out American foreign policy. And I wonder if this is another area that you may now feel that you made a mistake in dealing with the CIA, and maybe there is a larger message that can be gleaned from your experience. Maybe you could tell us whether or not the CIA is a legitimate way for the Americans to carry on foreign policy, making pawns out of yourself and other people around the world.
Yeah, that's a fair question, but I would like to tell you this at this time. First, I, in connection with what you mentioned, funds given to me, which is... it was an error of judgment on my part, and I don't have any bones in telling you that it was an error of judgment on my part, and that I could dedicate half an hour to giving you an explanation, not a justification, if you wish, but we will forego that. But I want to beg you to understand three things. One, that there is an investigation of the special prosecutor. In my case, what I have said already is all I have to say. I never had any access to the bank accounts of the Contras, neither I ever engaged in buying 1 pound of rice or one bullet or contracting one service. Okay, so it's very simple. I already said all I had to say. Through the length of 1 year, I have answered the curiosity of the media as far as the details. But I have been forewarned not to enter into details about it until I am called again. It's a second reason. While I believe that if ever again Nicaragua has to go through a similar experience, I think that covert operations should be put aside. Our history, senor, and I am using the time, I'm aware of it. Our history has been like this. All our wars have been fought in Nicaraguan blood, foreign weapons, and foreign aid in wherewithals to go with it. If we go to the 19th century, how were Nicaraguans able to expel the American adventurer, filibuster, William Walker, who had taken over our country? With Nicaraguan blood, with Costa Rican armies and blood, and with the money of guess who? Colonel Vanderbilt, Commodore Vanderbilt, Cornelius Vanderbilt. If we go to the so-called constitutional war in the 1920s, guess how we did it? Or how the liberals did it? On the government side, it was the US Marines protecting the government and money from the U.S. budget. And on the rebel side, it was Mexican weapons and Mexican money. And in that war, our hero, Augusto César Sandino, fought on the side of the rebels. I must tell you that Sandino invested his savings, his personal savings, in that war. If we come to the overthrow of Somoza, I was a witness to it, senor. It was Nicaraguan blood again, plus Venezuelan, Panamanian, Costa Rican to a certain extent, I mean, because the territory was allowed, and Cuban weapons. It was mostly Venezuelan money, which at the time, I must tell you, I recall that it was used for all the purposes, including the living expenses of Sergio Ramirez, of Miguel Escoto, of Joaquin Cuadra Chamorro, and all the leaders who lived there. And I didn't see anything strange about it. And by the way, in those days, I paid my trips to Costa Rica. One day, I'm going to publish a full account, because if 1 year after having left the country, they asked me about that, which is a mistake. I accept that it was a mistake. It was an error of judgment, mostly, more than anything else. I'm going to make present an account, complete account, because 1 year after they asking, continue to asking me about it, then let us be fair, I received an average of $6,000 to incur in several expenses, but including mine, which I did not want to hide under any euphemism. I didn't want to say, this is for the organization, or this is for that. If we have to divide that through all the years that I was involved in it, and that I've been involved in continuing, I assure you that it will be much, much less than what has been said. But something worries me about all this. And it is to believe that Americans cannot be able to distinguish between buying somebody and helping an ally. And I assure you, senor, that I am not for sale. I have never been sold myself. And that some would never buy me because it's ridiculous. And that I've shown my independence. And for that reason, perhaps, is that I have against me now everybody. Because I will not submit to that. But like I said, I mean, I for those reasons, I cannot talk about it. But I can anticipate to you something, that if there ever is another situation like that, I do hope that the CIA does what it should be doing, which is intelligence, and that you do openly provide your support to whoever allied you have it, and that you do it through the Army, through the Navy, through the regular channels, and that you do it in the open.
How are you holding out?
Holding, I'm fine.
All of them?
Yes, sir.
You proposed that the United States would support the Arias peace plan, and I assume that this would imply the stop of the Contra 8. How, in your opinion, would that affect the influence that the Soviet Union has in Nicaragua?
Well, that's one, I'm glad you mentioned that. Because I wrote a little piece in Los Angeles Times in August. Maybe you read it, and forgive me if I'm going to be repetitious, but there I said the following, that the virtues of the Arias plan is that it is like a computer program. We used to have a computer program fraught with bugs. He removed the bugs, established symmetries and so forth, and he established divisions of labor. One of them is, we Central Americans, he said, should be responsible for discussing the democratic steps that will, through this procedure, establish permanent and effective peace in Central America. But insofar as the fact that there is a threat of the establishment of a Soviet beachhead in Nicaragua, that should be the United States' concern. And that's been the proposal also for a long time of Ambassador Ambler Moss and others. Let the Central Americans discuss among themselves the means to achieve peace and democracy. And insofar as the danger of your geopolitical interest, I mean, might be in jeopardy, that can be the right arena to resolve that is a discussion between the United States as a world power and the Soviet Union, and that could help. Perhaps that there's something in the fact that after the assembly of the Sandinista Party had decried the Arias plan and said that there was nothing, Ortega went to Moscow and he returned with a different attitude. There may be something about that. And also, the Arias plan will finally tell us that once you have removed what the Sandinistas call U.S. aggression, and that they will have no pretext, we will see how the Sandinistas will manage the national economy, how they will manage the freedoms, what reasons they will have to shut down La Prensa, what reasons would they have, and so forth. I mean, so that's also another advantage. And it is also a good opportunity to prove something that has been said all along, that there are some pragmatic Sandinistas. Well, this is the time for them to prove it. And I believe that Ortega is trying to do something about it.
Okay, you do talk about Daniel Ortega being a pragmatist, and my question to you is he coming to these indirect talks with the Contras because of this moral imperative to do so by the Arias plan, or is it because of the renewed, the pressure that the Contras are putting militarily upon the Sandinistas?
Some people say that the Sandinistas have come to the negotiating table because the Contras are beating them. Yeah, that's a fact, yes, of course. The Sandinistas have two problems. One of them is the national economy. They need to reach some sort of an agreement with the private sector to produce again. But in order to obtain that, they have to create political conditions. And second, as I said, playing David against Goliath has become too costly for the Sandinistas. Although the Contras are unable to overthrow them, they have become a nuisance. I mean, too much problem. And they need that. But I don't believe that it is right to say that the Sandinistas have come to the negotiating table because of the pressure of the Contras. That is not to know the Sandinistas. The Sandinistas will never knuckle down and they will never cry uncle. That is wrong. That's a wrong approach. And I am not suggesting that those who favor, I mean, keeping on hold the Contras, that's right. I believe that they should receive non-lethal aid, I mean, and keep them as an option and so forth. But the reason the Sandinistas are coming to the negotiating table is because that Costa Rican young statesman has created such conditions that without losing face, the Sandinistas can go to the negotiating table. And also, if the Sandinistas are afraid of somebody, it's of the Costa Ricans. Because the Costa Rican moral authority in Central America is such that that's the stick that the president has been. This time, the Sandinistas have a choice. Either they consolidate their power through democratic reforms, the government, or they will face confrontation. And those who will be leading, the call for confrontation will be the Costa Ricans. He is afraid of the Costa Rican, not afraid of anything else.
Let's have our last question.
Yes, sir. Thank you. Yeah, because it's almost 10:30.
You just mentioned that the Costa Ricans were major force for the Arias plan in the region. Then my question would be, within Nicaragua, it seems like that it split the Contras and the Sandinistas. What kind of support is there within Nicaragua for the Arias plan? Is it realistic to expect that it would have support within the country?
That's a very good question. If you go through the Nicaraguan spectrum, Miami, for instance, before we go inside, 9 out of 10 persons in Miami are against the Arias plan. If you go among the bourgeoisie of Managua and the political leadership that you see every day, most of them are against the Arias plan. But if you go in the rural areas, they probably don't know exactly what the Arias plan is. But it's obvious that the people want peace. They want to find a way to put an end to the war. And if you go to sophisticated Nicaraguans or sophisticated friends of the Nicaraguans, for instance, in the Miami community, they are for the Arias plan. Now, there are two reasons why many Nicaraguans are against it. One is that they believe that only through force you can put an end to the Sandinista repression. Maybe they're right. But they fail to see that in order to reach a situation where you will be able to apply force, you first have to earn the political legitimacy which we do not have now. I mean, I didn't experience that I have had thus far is that if I go to Europe, I find that the Europeans consider the Nicaraguan opposition illegitimate. If you check with large segments of the American population, you find a similar attitude. And if you check Latin America, the same feeling. Therefore, Arias is giving us Nicaraguans the first opportunity to correct an error, because the whole thing was an error. The Sandinistas should have been left alone. And I assume the responsibility that I have to assume for my own faults. There should have never been any insurgency against the Sandinistas. And today, 8 years or 9 years after being in power, the church would be harassed, the prensa would have been shut down, there would not be freedom of expression, there would be no freedom of movement or anything. And they could not claim that there is a U.S. aggression against them. And they could not be calling the opposition mercenaries. And we would have all the moral authority to say, we have tried to accommodate ourselves with the Sandinista. Because that's another thing that people seem to ignore. People believe that the opposition in Nicaragua from the first day said, we are your enemies to the Sandinistas. And there was a whole process of persuasion, friendly persuasion. The opposition begged to them to come to an understanding. But their ideological arrogance has been against this. And that's what Arias is doing. All right, this is a lost game. Some people say, if we have contrast, we have hope. If we don't have contrast, everything is lost. That reasoning should be re-examined. It's Arias, the way to bring peace to Nicaragua and to bring democracy. But we have to be sincere about it. If again, I don't know if you're a Nicaraguan, are you? Okay. But again, if the world perceives us as being insincere, that all we want to do is to taunt the Sandinistas, that we go on telling, you're going to prove to me that you have freedom of the press and so on, we're lost. The right kind of answer is what that young lady of La Prensa, Cristiana Chamorro, according to the newspaper, has been giving. Are you being censored? No. Do you feel constrained? No. Do you feel that you have freedom? Yes. But when our right-wingers start to use a pencil, like I saw them in 1984, with the proposal for an understanding with the Sandinistas for the elections from the Colombian president, Betancourt, with a pencil, sharpening their eyes to find little ways of scuttling the proposal. Then we're lost. Thank you.